It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Kent, dozens of school districts around the state, including Milwaukee Public Schools, will ask voters for more money through referendums in the April election. We examine why nearly a quarter of Wisconsin school districts are seeking hundreds of millions of dollars and asking for voters for approval to exceed state revenue limits. Call in with a question. You can share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Rob Henken is president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. That's a statewide, nonpartisan, independent policy research organization. Rob, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
Your organization examines this April referendum where Milwaukee Public Schools is asking to exceed the state's revenue limit by up to $252 million phased in over 4 years. Why is the district seeking more money?
Well, it's a short question, but a lengthy answer. But let me see if I can trim it down a little bit.
We're in it.
Fundamentally, and the reason that we are seeing so many school districts throughout the state, there are actually 91 referendum questions affecting school districts on the ballot in April statewide. And what we, a main cause of this is the fact that the amount of money that school districts can raise via the property tax and their main form of state aid combined is capped by so-called state revenue limits. And year after year, or actually every 2 years as part of the state budget, determinations are made as to whether those revenue limits will go up, stay the same, match inflation, et cetera. There's no question that over the past decade and more, those revenue limits in terms of the increases in the revenue limits allowed for school districts have not kept pace with inflation. And that has been particularly problematic in the last 2 or 3 years as the rate of inflation has been particularly high. So we find NPS, as well as several other school districts, really struggling to keep up in terms of being able to compete in a very competitive labor market, which requires minimally providing cost of living pay adjustments for teachers, other costs related to school buildings and construction, certainly higher than they used to be. And so you put all of that together, and districts feel like they need to exceed those caps in order not to have to cut staff and reduce the quality of their educational programming.
So, but, you know, isn't it plausible that a steady and reliable increase in the revenue limit is necessary for a school district like Milwaukee, you know, to keep up with the increased costs of educating its students?
So I think that certainly a case can be made. There's one other side to the equation, however, and that is that a very key factor. So it's not only what the legislature does every 2 years as part of the budget, but there's a formula that determines the revenue limit amount for individual districts. Mm-hmm. And a very key part of that formula is school enrollment. So if you look at the Milwaukee Public Schools, we've documented, there's no question that the purchasing power of those revenue limit dollars has fallen dramatically. If the 2004 total for MPS would have been $1.3 billion if adjusted for inflation, their actual total in 2024 is about $900 million. Mm-hmm. So clearly not keeping pace. But at the same time, MPS's enrollment has dropped by about 32%. And so there is a question there. While clearly any government or school district should be able to expect revenues that grow minimally at the pace of inflation, when enrollment is dropping, there's also an opportunity to cut some costs. Now, the problem there is that that opportunity is not always proportionate with the drop in the dollars available.
So declining student enrollment does complicate the formula there. Rob Henken is president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum as we talk about Milwaukee Public Schools and school referendums across Wisconsin. Call in with a question. You can share your comments, 800-642-1234. Rob, you know, how much would an approved referendum like this one affect taxpayers in Milwaukee?
Well, I think that's really a big part of the issue here in Milwaukee is that, my sense is that if asking for more money is not as much the issue as how much more money they're actually asking for. So as you said, the referendum would provide up to $252 million above the cap that's phased in over 4 years. So that would gradually increase. But the cost on a the owner of a $200,000 property in Milwaukee that first year would be about $432 per, and that's per figures provided by MPS. One piece of good news that is often overlooked is that that $252 million would not only come from property taxpayers. So as a result of the district being able to spend more, that would positively impact their allocation under the revenue limit formula. So roughly $140 million or so of that $252 million would be from the property tax.
What, like, would a district be penalized in some way if they would exceed their, like, maximum allowable revenue without going to referendum?
Yes, that is a violation of state law. So these caps are essentially in state statute as part of the state budget. And so and you know, we focus on this money. Again, it's a lot of money for MPS, $900 million from the combined property taxes and state aids are about 90% of the district's budget for school operations. But there are other sources of revenue as well, particularly sources from the federal government that are directed toward districts with lots of disadvantaged students in terms of special needs and socioeconomic disadvantages. But yes, this form of money is this combined amount that is capped by the revenue limit is the most vital source of revenue, and these districts cannot exceed it without asking voters for permission.
Are these referendums, I mean, you mentioned the federal government, are these referendums in any way tied to a potential funding cliff, like coming with the end of pandemic era funding, like the ESSER money?
Absolutely. So I think that's another reason, not just the high rate of inflation. And I should mention, there were increases in the revenue limits of $325 per student in each year of the current 2 year budget. But another factor is that these federal pandemic relief dollars that have really been a lifesaver for many districts for the past 2, 3, 4 years, those need to be obligated by September of this year. So those dollars go away. Now, in an ideal world, districts would have been spending those dollars to deal with impacts of the pandemic that were hopefully one time in
One
nature and
time.
that are alleviating on things like facilities, where if you use the money to upgrade your facilities, you're not going to create a hole in the next year's budget because those facilities will already be upgraded. So to the extent that districts have used those dollars for one-time purposes, the loss of the dollars should not be as harmful. But I think that there are many districts that really had little choice but to plug at least some of these dollars into supporting their regular teacher workforce, for example. In the case of MPS, not only has that happened to a small extent, but the district has also used those dollars to support other specialized positions that it wanted to keep going. And so part of the referendum is really not just about maintaining the existing workforce and programs that are supported by the revenue limit dollars, but also filling some holes that will be created when those federal dollars go away.
We discussed school budget shortfalls, districts asking voters for additional money on the spring election ballot. Rob Henkin is here, president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, as we examine trends in school referenda, especially Milwaukee public schools. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts along the way at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Milwaukee Public Schools is one of about 100 districts that will ask voters in the spring election to increase their funding and attempt to close budget gaps amid inflation, as we've been talking about. Wisconsin Policy Forum is examining the case for referendums. It's President Rob Henkin with us. Be part of the conversation about school funding. Call in with a question. You can add your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Rob, your organization reports a groundswell of school referendums in the state over the past decade. Can you explain a bit historically why are more school districts turning to referendums to fund their schools?
So, first of all, you have to look at the different types of referendums. And so I think an important distinction here is districts that are going to voters for permission to do major rehabilitation of school buildings, including potential upgrades to school athletic facilities and so forth, versus so-called operating referenda, which involve being able to, on an ongoing basis, exceed those state-imposed revenue limits. Starting with the operating referendum, really, again, it is the fact that over time, for a variety of different reasons, these revenue limits that have been put in place to try to control the impacts on property taxpayers, those have not tended to increase at the pace of inflation. And so districts find themselves having to make very difficult decisions. The amount of dollars that they can generate under these limits typically comprise by far the most sizable share of their school operations budgets. And so when those dollars just are not growing with inflation, and when there is a need, particularly in an historically tight labor market, to be wary of that and to minimally provide cost of living salary and benefit adjustments to teachers, if you want to do that and your revenues are not growing at a pace that will allow you to do it, then you may need to look at having fewer teachers. And fewer teachers obviously can have impacts in the classroom. And so you really have to go district by district, Kate. I mean, each one has an individual story. And again, typically roughly a third to half have been these building referenda. And, we have old infrastructure and buildings do fall apart. And, these big school buildings reach a point at times where it's more cost effective to essentially just tear it down and build a new one than to try to keep on fixing it. And so when that happens, that's obviously quite expensive. The other thing we're seeing, of course, is the construction costs have gone up in recent years. And so all of those factors have converged for several districts. And we're seeing referenda in wealthier districts and poorer districts, in urban districts and in rural districts. It's really been pretty uniform across the state.
Across the board there. Let's take a call. Casey in Juneau County is with us. Casey, hi.
Hi. So several years ago, when interest rates were really low, we had a referendum. We got a new elementary school out of it and a bunch of remodels for our school district. And that was an easy yes because of the interest rates. And here we are again. We are having another referendum on the ballot. But last year or the year before, I think it was last year, they re-evaluated everybody's property taxes, and ours went up substantially, which in my mind would then give the school districts more money. But here they are asking for money again. So maybe I'm just not understanding the exact formula when it comes to that. But in my mind, because my property taxes are going up already, they would be getting more money.
Casey, thank you. Rob, can you explain a bit about that formula and the reassessment?
Yes. So the reassessments really, so if when your property is reassessed, and no question, property values across the state of Wisconsin are going up, and that's a good thing for the economy, not as good for your property tax bill, potentially. But essentially, that doesn't create more money for the government because the levy amount is still capped. So when people's assessed value changes, it sort of redistributes the money. It lowers the rate for everybody. So if you're fortunate enough not to have had your property reassessed in a given year, your neighbors who maybe did have their property values go up would end up paying more. That's one of the catches, and it's a great question because it's commonly misunderstood, is that as property values increase, it doesn't necessarily mean that the amount of property tax levy that local governments and school districts are able to make as part of their annual budgets, that those levy collections are going up, because typically those levy amounts are capped in the case of school districts by these revenue limits, which actually caps the combined amount of state aids and levy. And in the case of local governments, there's a cap on the amount of levy that can be raised by local governments.
Casey, thank you for that call. Casey, they're seeing it on the ballot. Historically, how often do Wisconsin voters support these school referendums?
We had found up until the last set of elections last year that the percentage was really pretty high, and typically in the 60 to 80% range. We have other members of our staff who are better experts than I am on the statewide referenda, so don't take those numbers verbatim. But certainly pretty high levels of support. We saw that drop in 2023 in the last round of referenda, still around 50%. I know in February, so we have again 91 referenda across the state coming up in April. This past February for the primary elections, we had 10, and in the Southeast Wisconsin region, I believe there were four, and each of them were defeated. So I think your caller's question is really indicative, perhaps, of what many people are feeling. They want to support their school districts, but these levy amounts are growing and home values are growing, and people are seeing the increase in their property taxes. We also every year take a look at the property taxes that are levied statewide, and we expected to see, because of not only levy limits, but also the fact that for local governments, there was an increase in the shared revenue program for the first time in decades, that maybe the growth in property taxes would slow down, but it was still well over 3% statewide.
Rob Henkin with us, president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, as we discuss school referendums, specifically Milwaukee Public Schools. Call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Rob, turning to special education funding, among the largest school districts in the state, Milwaukee serves the highest percentage of students from economically disadvantaged backgrounds. How does serving more students from low-income families affect the district's needs?
It's a great question, Kate, and I'm really glad you brought it up because that's one other big part of the equation here that we have not discussed. So school districts, all public school districts have certain mandates from the federal and state government that they must follow in terms of educating students with special needs. And there's no question that it is more expensive to educate students who have special needs. There's also been research finding that it costs more to educate students who have a whole variety of disadvantages, socioeconomic disadvantages, et cetera. So for a school district like the Milwaukee Public Schools, which has a very high proportion of socioeconomically disadvantaged students, there are clearly higher costs. Now, there is a form of special state categorical aid that helps districts pay for these extra costs associated with special education. And there has been a lot of discussion in Madison over the past several years about the need to increase that pool of money. Essentially, what has happened is that the costs there have risen faster than the state has been able to increase the dollars available for special education. So that right now, school districts in state law, the goal is to have roughly 30% of those costs for special education reimbursed. But that is far lower than, say, 2 decades ago when more than half of those costs were covered with state aid.
In our final moments together, state lawmakers might say, look, the state has a commitment to fund two-thirds of the cost of public schools. We're doing it. What are school districts seeking from state lawmakers at this point?
Well, I think number one, greater elasticity in those revenue limits. I mentioned the $325 per student that is happening both in this school year and in the next school year. That's obviously going to help, but the Legislative Fiscal Bureau has found that even with those increases, if you look back over the past several years, those revenue limits still have lagged inflation. Certainly more special education funding is something that school districts across the state have been pushing for. When they are not getting reimbursed at traditional levels for those costs, it means that they have to take their general monies available for all students and use those to serve students with special needs.
Rob, thank you for joining us.
There's a lot of agreement.
Oh,
The
Rob,
problem.
thank you for joining us. Rob Henkin is president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We discuss pressing issues for the technical college system in Wisconsin as President Morna Foy prepares to leave the post overseeing 16 technical colleges. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about someone reaching for their goals.
Earning a master's degree and launching a business is no easy feat. WPR's Margaret Faust met Jordan Schrader of Grafton to see how he did it while also living with a rare genetic neuromuscular disease.
I turn voice control on.
Hey Siri, open my queue, show grid, click 18. Taking a walk is like my prayer walk. I go out and talk to God, and this is when I usually really have my seclusion time with the Lord.
This is Jordan Schrader. The 30-year-old rides his wheelchair down the block in his neighborhood on a brisk afternoon. He has type 1 spinal muscular atrophy, a genetic disorder where muscles don't respond to signals from motor neurons. The muscles gradually weaken and shrink from inactivity. Schrader says growing up, he felt like he was missing out on things like sports and dancing with girls.
When you're sitting down and you can't barely move, you feel trapped. Like you're always watching and spectating. You feel like you're never really like actively participating.
Gradually, he lost voluntary movement in his limbs. Only slight movements remain. He uses a motorized wheelchair to get around.
I'm praying and praying for these things, but none of the things I wanted at the time I thought were being answered. They were being answered, but in different ways I did not yet understand.
Schrader was born and raised Pentecostal Christian. He went to church every Sunday, and he thought he'd make a full-time career out of it.
I went to school for 8 years and all that. I got my master's in divinity. Yeah, I got ordained, but I never yet found my church staff position because I don't think the church in general is ready yet for disabled pastors.
In 2020, at the age of 27, Schrader says he hit rock bottom and went to a dark place. But then he asked himself,
what do I have left? Literally my voice. I'm like, okay, I can speak.
This was a turning point for Schrader. So he harnessed the power of his voice. Eventually, he delivered a TEDx talk about being a person with a disability. He felt inspired to start a motivational speaking business. His elevator pitch?
Tony Robbins, but crippled. Like, I want to help people like get up and walk into their destiny that God has planned for them. They just don't know it yet.
He also hosts a podcast called Handy Schlapped, where he talks about everything from disabilities to pop culture.
What is up, everyone? It is so good to be with you finally. What a crazy year.
He's also written and directed a number of short films. Rose of Sharon, his most recent work, is about a newly widowed mother who must cope with being the sole caregiver of her disabled teenage son. It won 2 awards in Green Bay. Through all of his media, he hopes to lift others up.
A bad day doesn't equal a bad life. You know, you have a choice, and it doesn't matter the circumstance. It's how you respond to the circumstances. It's not exactly a new idea, but everyone for the rest of mankind is going to need that reminder and that motivation.
And when he's not creating media, he loves to play video games in his downtime.
Fallout, Dead Space, BioShock is one of my all-time favorite games. Then I'll be like, Alexa, turn on the TV. Alexa, go to HDMI 3. And just like that, it'll start.
As he looks ahead to this next stage of life, Schrader says he wants to focus on his talents and help others take hold of their potential.
WPR's Margaret Faust brought us that story on Jordan Schrader of Grafton. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Board members of the Wisconsin Technical College System will meet next week at Moraine Park Technical College in Fond du Lac. One item on their agenda could be a presidential search process, as Morna Foy recently announced her retirement as president of the 16 technical colleges in the state. Call in with a question. You can share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. President Morna Foy, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate.
Why have you decided to step back now and retire this year?
Well, you know, it's tough. And actually hearing stories like Jordan's, I get to hear stories like that from Wisconsin's technical college students all the time. They are inspiring and it is tough. It's tough to take the next step. But I've been doing this work for quite a while now. And I think the system is just in a terrific place. Really strong leadership and staff and faculty at our colleges and in the system. Our enrollments are on the rise again. We've made a lot of great changes in response to the needs of our students and our employers and our communities that we serve. And I think we just have a really good collaborative culture that puts the system as a whole in a good place to meet the challenges that are definitely on the horizon. Lots of things going on, but you know, I look back and I think, you know, I have worked in the tech college system through 5 different administrations. I've had the chance to work with over 50 incredible college leaders, worked, you know, side by side with hundreds of dedicated volunteer board members and system colleagues, state and local policymakers. It's just been a terrific career and a terrific ride. I love my job. I think that's the best time to be able to try some things new. And I really think that change is a way that we grow as individuals and as organizations. And you know, I feel like the system's in a great place, and it's time.
I think you could also say the same for the system itself. It has to grow and change in order to meet the demands of work in Wisconsin. And you've been traveling.
Absolutely.
You've been traveling the state and visiting the colleges. Mm-hmm. What are you learning from these visits?
I mean, it's just been an absolute blast. And it's just been, you know, it's easy to get caught up in the struggles that we all have. And in the changing, you know, some of the hard changes that the world is going through. But when I go out to our colleges and I get a chance to interact with our students and I see the way that they are investing in themselves and investing in their communities that they live in, it is just, it's so inspiring and it's so optimistic There is just a lot of excitement among our students about their career choices, about what they're learning. I've been learning a lot of new options or new careers from our students, actually, and from the faculty that inspire them. And it's you know, it makes it, in some ways, it makes me want to go back to school. It makes me want to think about other career choices. There are so many amazing ways to spend one's time and careers to pursue, Kate. It's just, it's mind-boggling, really. And it's exciting because there's a lot of Wisconsinites who are really jazzed up about what they're planning to do with their lives and how they're going to get there. And that's really what I'm getting the chance to see that up front and firsthand as I go around to our colleges.
Well, let's talk about the revenue that it takes to go after these pursuits and create these programs. There was a recent Wisconsin Policy Forum report estimating the state's technical colleges receive about $5,000 more in tax and tuition per full-time student compared to other two-year institutions nationwide. But that number may be inflated because colleges serve many part-time students. How do technical colleges use the revenue that's generated from student tuition and fees and the receiving at the local level?
Well, I think it's all you need to do is step on campus and you can see why we get the support that we get. I think that the policy forum study they came out with a follow-up acknowledging the fact that these kinds of national comparisons are very tough because it's hard for them to really recognize differences in what is being delivered and funding choices that different states make historically. So in Wisconsin, the technical colleges are responsible for many services and programs that we do not collect tuition for. The state made decisions long time ago that these were public services that we wanted to support with public state and local funding and investments. Mm-hmm. So that explains a lot of the difference. Why those kinds of programs, things like adult basic education and English language learning, our fire service training here in Wisconsin is provided by technical colleges for free to fire departments and aspiring firefighters. But we also have, a real focus on the most expensive kind of higher education. Hmm. Career and technical education, highly, emphasizing technology and state-of-the-art equipment so that we can keep aligned with what employers and industry is doing. And then, of course, accessibility. We are open enrollment institutions. The vast majority of our students go part-time. And frankly, part-time students don't pay as much in tuition, obviously, as a full-time student would. Mm-hmm. But they still have all the same needs in terms of support, learning spaces, tutoring, all these services that every college student expects. And the other thing that I think technical colleges are well known for, but it is expensive, is that we are highly flexible and responsive to working adults. So that means offering programming in a lot of different formats, virtually, in person, a combination. And the technology that's required to do that and the flexibility in curriculum and in supporting students and allowing them to access those courses in different ways. There's a cost to all of that. Lastly, the vast majority of our students are in programs that require expensive equipment, that have the faculty who, frankly, have a higher paying options out in the private industry.
You would need to pay your instructors more who have this technical expertise to prevent them from like being recruited by private industry.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have to compete with industry for engineers and dentists and, you know, folks who have very desirable mm-hmm. and well-compensated skill sets. All of our faculty are required to have worked in industry, and they bring those skills and expertise into the classroom.
Morna Foy is president of the Wisconsin Technical College System, and you can be part of the conversation about technical training programs, about workforce needs, what you're seeing. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Technical College System offers hundreds of programs. It's the largest higher education system in the state. We examine pressing workforce needs, and you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Add your perspective. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Morna Foy with us, president of the Wisconsin Technical College System. Governor Evers declared 2024 as the year of the worker in his State of the State address and pledged that his administration would focus on work-related issues like affordable housing and childcare, paid family leave. How could lawmakers help address the state's workforce challenges?
I think there's a lot of different approaches and strategies that would help improve Wisconsin's workforce challenges. And I think the governor has laid out quite a few that have been talked about in both in the legislature and among groups like the Governor's Council on Workforce Investment for a number of years. Childcare is a continual concern here in Wisconsin. And I hear that from employers all the time, as well as our students, frankly. But I think the other ways, to directly affect the technical college students is investments in both our colleges and also our students. Student financial aid is an important tool for some students in order to be able to access higher education. And it's an area where Wisconsin has not kept up with some of our neighboring states. So that's a bit of a concern. I think the other area that the legislature did recently invest in and that I think is going forward going to be an important sort of shift in higher ed is the availability of open educational resources. So basically textbooks that are available to students online and that they don't have to pay for. So in our system, again, with a lot of our technical programs, in healthcare programs, textbooks can be a significant
very steep cost
for students. Uh-huh. And it really would help, I think, open educational resources. They're getting better. We've had some real success in terms of benefit to students in recent years. And I think that that is a strategy that definitely deserves support going forward. And that's across all higher education sectors, truly.
Let's bring on a call. Justin in Waukesha is here. Justin, hello.
Hi.
What would you like to bring up?
Well, I had graduated from MSCC with my degree in fire science, and now I'm looking to get into psychology. I know, or from what I understand, technical colleges don't offer those kind of degrees, and I live much closer to, for instance, Waukesha, WCTC, than I do UW schools. I was just wondering if there is an idea for partnership at all to make all of the.
Oh, Justin, you're breaking up a bit, but is wondering about is there more partnerships that could be opened up here between technical colleges and the universities of Wisconsin system?
Actually, this Justin's hit on something that is a high priority for our system, and I think that there'll be a many, he'll be seeing many more such partnerships going forward, but we've done a lot of work over the years to partner with the UW system or the Universities of Wisconsin. And I think that right now that is kind of at an apex. There's interest in both directions. And that's frankly, because I think our faculty have spent more time with each other over the years. They have a better understanding of what's going on each of our campuses. Now that all of the technical colleges can offer an Associate of Arts in Science, which would be the first 2 years essentially of many different fields that we have not traditionally pursued. You know, so it's like, he's right. We don't offer bachelor's degrees, and we do not offer a bachelor's degree in sociology. Mm-hmm. But we do offer general education courses, and we do offer related courses that or program areas that can now be applied and transferred to bachelor's degree programs in the University of Wisconsin. So he, as you know, you can go to any technical college regardless of where you live. But Waukesha County Technical College has a fairly robust relationship with UW-Milwaukee, mm-hmm. as well as, so does MATC for that matter, in certain degree areas. And I expect those degree areas to grow. So what our ideal, of course, is that we'd like to have agreements with four-year partners that take the entire credential from a technical college and apply that to your new degree at the University of Wisconsin. So that we're trying to basically make it easier for students. They have to, they don't have to figure out which classes they took will transfer. They don't have to.
More seamless environment, yeah, there.
It's just not. We don't want to leave it all on them to figure it out. Mm. We want to lay the pathway out for them, and so they can make a choice, and that they also can plan ahead better. Both, and it's not just in college. Once you get to college, we've seen just huge growth in our dual credit programs with high school students. Mm-hmm. Last year, we had almost 300,000 Wisconsin high school students were earning technical college credit while they were still in high school. We've seen over 20% growth in our dual credit enrollments in the last 5 years. And, now I was just at Gateway Technical College a couple of weeks ago, meeting with high school students who will get, they will graduate from high school, and they will also be getting their associate degree from Gateway Technical College at the same time. So that is the accelerated pathway that for some students is, ideal. And then they're moving into some cases to work, but in other cases directly into a four-year program when they're 18.
With those credits with them. Morna Foy, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. And thanks, Kate, for all the coverage and for inviting me on your show.
And the conversations.
Really appreciate it.
Yes. Morna Foy, president of the Wisconsin Technical College System. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We get a roundup of business and workforce development news in Wisconsin with WPR reporter Joe Schultz as our guide. And you can be part of the discussion as we examine the forces affecting our state's economy and its workforce. Call in with a question. Share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Joe, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
So we're hearing this morning about the Wisconsin State Climatology Office saying this season is the warmest winter on record. Is there a connection here with the booming construction workforce and those numbers that we're seeing in January?
There might be. So last week, the Department of Workforce Development kind of announced they had their monthly jobs report. And state economist Dennis Winters spoke about the warmer than usual winter when he talked about construction jobs. And he kind of tied it to You know, Wisconsin's setting a new record for total construction jobs in the month of January. Normally, our construction season runs from April to November. And, you know, some other economists that I talked to said that it might have been a factor as well. But we did have a cold spell in January. It got pretty chilly kind of in the middle of the month before it warmed up again. So kind of hard to say definitively, but I think it does. It probably did play a role.
So what might be causing this construction boom?
That's kind of like the old adage of you ask a question to five different people, you get five different responses.
Or five different economists in this instance, yes.
Yeah, or unions or associations or whatever.
Sure, sure.
So the Wisconsin Builders Association, they kind of pointed to stabilizing interest rates. There hasn't been an interest rate hike in quite some time. And they said that that's given builders a little bit more certainty, especially for like housing projects and bigger housing projects. An Iron Workers Union based in Madison, they told me that, you know, the federal investments in the state's infrastructure have really played a role. And then, you know, another economist that I spoke to kind of pointed to a national boom in construction, specifically of, you know, building manufacturing facilities. So it kind of varies, but it's probably, you know, kind of a combination of all those factors.
The source who brought up the connection to the dollars flowing in, like from the bipartisan infrastructure law and the upgrades we're seeing in roads and bridges and other projects, what impact could that be a catalyst for this job surge?
So it's, you know, there's more money flowing to the state from the federal government in terms of, you know, just like funding some of these projects. You know, there's certain projects that local governments just kind of like need grants for, or like grants are super helpful for building, you know. So just kind of with more funding coming in, it kind of gives, you know, it gives resources to help kind of invest in infrastructure and make sure that, you know, our bridges are safe and we have roads to drive on. And then, you know, there's the union who brought up that, you know, is kind of based in Madison, and they kind of pointed toward expanding apprenticeship programs in trade unions as another kind of piece that is really important as well.
I wonder, is this workforce boom sustainable? I mean, how long will this last?
If I knew the answer to that, I might, you know, be spending some more time on Wall Street. I'm not really sure. But, you know, I think in the immediate term, it'll be interesting to see the numbers. When we get out of January and into February, March, April, May, just because, like, you know, in Wisconsin, we all know, we've all experienced, you know, construction season on highways and our roadways and stuff, and had to kind of plan our travels accordingly. So I think when we see the numbers for peak construction season, that'll be really interesting, and it'll give us a little bit better indicator of, you know, is this boom in jobs just kind of short term? You know, once we start really building out infrastructure, you know, what does it kind of look like? I think that'll be very interesting kind of as we get the numbers as the summer kind of rolls on.
WPR reporter Joe Schultz with us as we talk about Wisconsin economic news and the impacts to different workforces. You can join in questions and comments at 800-642-1234. You reported on new workforce figures from the Wisconsin Hospital Association. What are you learning about vacancies in the state hospitals and clinics?
So the Wisconsin Hospital Association puts out a workforce report each year. And this year they found that the overall vacancy rate for staffing in Wisconsin hospitals was unchanged from 2021 to 2022. It stayed at about 10%. And that's, you know, that's not good. The Hospital Association says that that's still really high, but it didn't increase. So I guess that's kind of good news. And, you know, 8 out of the 18 healthcare professions that the report tracked had double digit vacancy rates. And, you know, that can affect patients from anything from you know, having to wait a little longer to schedule an appointment with your physician, to, you know, maybe having longer wait times if you go to the emergency room, or, you know, in some cases it even forces hospitals to close down certain services that they offer, and then you'd have to drive a little further to get that service. So it's, yeah, still really high vacancy rates, but they didn't increase kind of overall.
And considering Wisconsin is an aging state, how acute could this workforce shortage, even if it's sustained right now, how acute could it become in future years?
So people over 65 require more health care than, you know, the younger population. So in 2021, people 65 or older made up less than 20% of the U.S. population, but they accounted for 40% of healthcare spending. And by 2030, the Hospital Association anticipates that almost all baby boomers will be of retirement age by 2030. And, you know, the workforce shortage in hospitals it could be a real issue, because demand for healthcare is only going to increase by the end of the decade as more people reach retirement age. So, you know, they really want to figure this workforce challenge out. One of the things that someone from the association kind of told me was that, you know, for other industries, you know, the flow of retirements, they call it the silver tsunami, that's going to end. But for hospitals, this increase in demand from baby boomer retirements is going to persist for a couple decades.
Hmm. Let's bring in Chris in Columbus. Hi, Chris.
Hey, great show as usual. I am a nurse, and I do contract nursing all across the state. And I can tell you that that Wisconsin Hospitals report is rosy at best. All the hospitals are critically short-staffed, especially in support staff. I mean, we're having to draw our own labs because we don't have enough phlebotomists to get up to draw labs on time. We don't have enough CNAs to do just basic patient care. Nurses are critically short-staffed. And the unnecessary COVID cash, ballooned budgets, and now everybody's cutting back, laying off staff, shifting them to contractors, delaying raises or bonuses. The financial picture in the healthcare industry is horrid, and it's largely due to federal dollar mismanagement. And
Chris, thank you so much for calling in. Have you heard this Joe Schultz, this on-the-ground scenario there that Chris is laying out?
Not directly. Mm-hmm. I think HSHS in Western Wisconsin, there's a lot of turmoil with, a hospital system out in Western Wisconsin. I know Marshfield Clinic Health System had big layoffs last year. And, you know, he's not wrong about, you know, health systems are cutting back, but I haven't heard from, you know, experts or officials kind of regarding some of the other stuff, you mm-hmm. know. And I have heard that it's financially kind of challenging for hospitals because of they kind of point to Medicaid reimbursement, and that, you know, Medicaid funds hospitals under the cost of care is mm-hmm. kind of what the association points to a lot of times. And, you know, I'm sure that, you know, the shortage of workers is definitely burning out, you know, the staff that are at these hospitals. Like that's definitely happening. And I, you know, the association kind of said as much to me earlier this week when we wrote that story, was that, you know, when hospitals are short staffed, like other workers have to pick up extra hours, they have to work overtime to try to fill the gaps. And it's, yeah, I'm sure that's super tough for healthcare workers right now.
Joe Schultz is a WPI reporter as we explore latest developments affecting Wisconsin's business sector, its healthcare sector. You can join in the discussion, call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine major forces affecting our state's top industries with a roundup of business and workforce development news. Joe Schultz is a WPR reporter, and you can bring your questions, your thoughts to the discussion. Call in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Joe, let's turn to artificial intelligence. The governor's task force on workforce and artificial intelligence convened this month to work on its game plan for embracing AI. Here's Department of Workforce Development Secretary designee Amy Pachek.
We're just going to keep making those connections to make sure that we are prepared for the changes that AI is going to bring. And that includes making sure our students are prepared, our workers are prepared, and our businesses are prepared to really adopt this technology so they can stay competitive and Wisconsin can stay strong.
Okay, so a lot of stress there on preparation. What does that mean?
The Department of Workforce Development, WEDC and the Department of Administration all had their top officials at the task force meeting this month in Oshkosh. They want to make sure that as we continue to kind of embrace AI in the workplace, that we're not leaving workers behind. And, you know, they're going to come up with kind of a recommendation plan for Governor Tony Evers, and that'll get included in his next state budget proposal. They said that, you know, workforce development and education are going to be kind of key to ensuring that, you know, workers already in the workforce who, you know, didn't learn about AI in school when they were kind of coming up and getting their education, to make sure that there's, you know, programs to help kind of train them in AI so they don't get left behind. That's kind of the biggest key is they're trying to figure out, you know, what do workers kind of need to know about AI? How can AI be used in the workplace? And how can we kind of augment workers without, you know, necessarily fully replacing humans? I think they want to avoid, you know, the Terminator movie.
Well, AI is a moving target. How are employers and labor leaders reacting to this evolution and advancements in AI?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. They had the meeting at Oshkosh Corp's global headquarters, and you know, we heard from the guy leading AI efforts at Oshkosh Corp, and he mentioned that, you know, they're using tools like ChatGPT, generative AI tools, to, you know, kind of write, you know, emails to suppliers and kind of automate some basic kind of office tasks that AI can handle. But, you know, they're also kind of working with their workforce at Oshkosh Corp to, you know, illustrate like what are the things AI just can't do yet. And, you know, labor leaders really kind of hammered home that message of, you know, we don't want workers to be left behind. We like technological advancements that make our jobs safer, that make our work more efficient, but we don't want to devalue work in that process. I think companies are using AI to kind of augment their workforce right now. That was what Oshkosh Corp said, you know, and I think, you know, labor leaders, the task force heard from the AFL-CIO, They just want to make sure that workers are protected and that workers aren't replaced and that, you know, work still has a value, even in kind of an age of AI.
I mean, what conceivably can these task forces accomplish? I mean, we've got one in the legislature, we've got one with the governor. What can they accomplish?
So the governor's task force, they're going to work on a plan that they're going to present to the governor that's going to include proposals for like funding for workforce development and education programs kind of around AI.
Mm-hmm.
I think in Wisconsin we see the budget process kind of play out where the governor kind of presents the budget to the legislature. The legislature makes big revisions and, you know, sometimes starts from the ground up. So it'll be interesting to kind of see how that plays out, you know, politically in Wisconsin with divided government. But I think, you know, just kind of having that conversation is probably important because it gets folks kind of thinking about AI.
Mm-hmm. and what others around the table are thinking as well. WPR reporter Joe Schultz with us as we talk about Wisconsin economic news and workforce. You can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Let's turn to diversity in businesses. And you report Wisconsin businesses owned by people of color account for over $1.6 billion in payroll. What effect is growing diversity in business ownership having on our state economy?
Yeah, so that number is from a new UW Extension report. And the researchers found that, you know, from 1997 to 2012, growth of diverse businesses, businesses owned by people of color, outpaced growth of non-minority owned businesses in Wisconsin. And I think, you know, the effect of that is, one of the businesses that I spoke to was an African grocery store in Green Bay. And the co-owner there mentioned that, you know, there's an immigrant population in Green Bay, and they're providing kind of this essential service of, you know, providing food that's, you know, closer to the food they would have had in, you know, where the in their home countries. And that's a really important service. They provide, you know, those cultural benefits like that. And then, you know, the benefit is just kind of the same as it is for most of our small businesses in terms of, you know, making sure that our communities aren't just, you know, Targets and Walmarts and everything else, that, that we have, you know, a strong small business economy in Wisconsin. So, you know, because that's kind of what makes our communities communities at the end of the day, is those, you know, unique businesses that you can't find anywhere else.
What barriers surfaced here? What barriers do underrepresented groups face to start businesses in Wisconsin?
The biggest one is funding. It can be really tough to secure loans, and financing is what I heard from a couple small businesses in Wisconsin.
Access to capital.
There was a chocolatier in Madison, and, you know, she had to cash out her retirement, and, you know, her mom had to take out a mortgage on the family home in order for her to, you know, get a brick and mortar location. And it's really kind of financing. Lending discrimination is a big issue as well. And, you know, same with the grocery store in Green Bay that I spoke with. You know, they it took them about 2 years to make their dream a reality because they had to secure the financing.
Did the report indicate, are there any rural and urban divides in minority business ownership?
Not exactly. So what we learned was that, you know, there are minority businesses kind of across the state, in every corner of the state, probably a little more concentrated in those urban areas, where, you know, there just are by number, you know, more people of color in general in urban areas. But it didn't really necessarily go into the rural urban divide too much in the report.
Beyond access to capital, are there disparities more pronounced among certain ethnicities in business ownership in Wisconsin?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So there was a really nice graph in the report, actually, that really illustrated that. Yeah, so Asian-owned businesses are represented roughly the same as, you know, their share of the population. But, you know, Black-owned and Latino-owned businesses are underrepresented. You know, we have fewer businesses by proportion of, you know, the number of businesses than we do African-Americans or Hispanic individuals in the state.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for your reporting. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was really fun.
Joe Schultz is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine technology transfer in psychedelic research and a race for pharmaceutical patents. A Wisconsin symposium highlights the latest studies and new challenges in the psychedelics industry. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Paul Hudson is director of the UW-Madison Transdisciplinary Center for Research in Psychoactive Substances, professor at the UW School of Pharmacy. And David Casimir is a patent attorney, co-founder of the Madison-based nonprofit Porta Sophia, a library of information on psychedelic substances. David, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
You started Porta Sophia in 2020. What is the organization trying to solve?
We recognized that there was a problem related to patenting in the field of psychedelic medicine. And in particular, we were seeing the Patent Office grant a surprisingly large number of patents that we believe should not have been granted. And when we dug into that, we were realizing that they were not finding the information needed to prevent those patents from making it through the process. And so Porta Sophia was created to collect that information and make it readily available to the Patent Office and anyone else in the world who wants to see it.
The patent officials assemble what's known as prior art. Can you explain what prior art is?
Yeah, prior art is sort of the collection of publicly known information that exists before a particular patent application is filed. And for a patent to be granted, it has to be new and non-obvious in view of all of the prior art.
New and non-obvious. And so some psychedelics like psilocybin or magic mushrooms are grown naturally, been used for centuries by indigenous groups. How can a company patent a product like that?
In theory, they should not be able to patent a product that replicates what has been done in the past, what was in the prior art or out there in the public domain. And we've definitely seen various entities trying to patent such things. To obtain a real patent, some actual innovation would have to happen. So some new discovery on a new compound, or perhaps new ways to formulate it, but something that sort of requires lab work.
Paul, what is the environment like out there? How much demand exists for companies to create patents around psychedelic substances or therapies?
There is a perception that there's a lot of money to be made in this space and a lot of interest, of course, in psychedelic and psychoactive drugs. And we've seen a lot of investor money put into various startup companies that have been looking for a hook, if you will, to be able to set in a piece of intellectual property that they can commodify or commercialize. And it's proving difficult. There's been some contraction in the industry recently. And as David knows, there's a lot of competition for various aspects of how not only what the compound is that's being used, but how one might use it, what kind of environment it's being used in. So there's a lot of jostling for seats here.
You know, David, can you just step back for a moment and explain the importance of patents in what they do in the drug development process and what they could be protecting in the case of emerging psychedelics and this research area?
Sure. Yeah. So a patent is a government-granted right, and it effectively gives to an inventor a limited monopoly. And if someone gets a patent granted, they have the exclusive right for approximately 20 years to determine who gets to make, use, or sell a particular innovation. And so it's a powerful right because it effectively controls a market for a particular product or service for a 20-year period. So, please.
Was going to say, you interact with patent attorneys. You know, how much energy and, you know, what is it like in terms of patent attorneys focusing on psychedelic substances in this moment?
Well, and yeah, so patent attorneys are essentially hired by innovators, which could be universities or companies or individuals or investment groups, to file patent applications on their behalf. And what we've seen, especially in the last 3 to 4 years, is an exponential increase in the filing of patent applications related to psychedelics.
One patent that gained your attention was this mental health care company attempting to patent psilocybin to treat depression. What happened in that particular case?
Yeah, so in that particular case, a very broad patent application was filed. When you looked at the broadest coverage they were seeking, it was attempting to cover psilocybin to treat depression and included aspects of set and setting, which is effectively the environment in which the drug would be administered to a patient. And that patent caused a lot of uproar because it was claiming things that I think everyone in the field recognized were already known, things that were in the prior art.
What is the situation around that particular case now? Where does it stand?
So Porta Sophia, the organization I work with, not only creates this public library, but we also reach out directly to the patent offices around the world to inform them of this prior art and to try to prevent overly broad patents from being granted. And in this particular case, we filed a submission to the U.S. Patent Office identifying that what was being claimed in this patent was not novel. And the patent owner voluntarily changed their claims to make them substantially narrower after our submission.
David Casimir, patent attorney, co-founder of Porta Sophia, nonprofit library of information on psychedelic substances. Paul Hudson with us directs the UW-Madison Transdisciplinary Center for Research in Psychoactive Substances. You can join in with a question. Call in with your comments at any point, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Paul, when you see the patenting attempts in existing drugs like psilocybin, maybe LSD, ecstasy, does that have an effect on your research? Could that have a chilling effect on research communities?
It can. Typically, we are working with the companies that are making the product, and we are able to get the drug through typically either donations or increasingly having to pay for it. I'm not sure that it's a barrier if they're trying to make a patent at this point, but it does become more difficult to do the research when they are trying to protect their intellectual property and the university expects to have its own access to that same intellectual property. So there's a bit of a competition there about who has the rights to the science that is developed when we do these clinical studies.
Could corporate interests take the psychedelics field of research in a new direction?
I think that they are trying very much to do that because the new direction may be something that they can patent, maybe not the drug so much mm-hmm. as the use. And David would be able to comment on that better than I.
David, are companies attempting to patent psychedelic therapies in addition to psychedelic substances? What do you see?
Absolutely. I would say that's been one of the major strategies used by companies. For example, one of the patents that we saw early on that led us to want to form Porta Sophia was a group of investors out of Silicon Valley had filed and got granted a patent on the use of LSD to treat allergies. So the patent office allows you to patent use of known drugs for new indications. Although when it comes to psychedelics, it's, I think, hard to find a truly new indication.
That's interesting. And, you know, in terms of even the delivery of psychoactive substances and the environment in which the therapy would happen, are there patent attempts there as well?
There are. There was actually a fairly controversial patent granted by the patent office on the use of a vaping device for delivery of psychedelics.
And what happened there? What was the issue?
So the knowledge that vaping devices can be used with psychedelics is known in the prior art. Patent office did not identify that prior work and granted the patent. So that is still a patent sitting out there right now, potentially able to be enforced.
Mary from La Crosse called in. Mary says that they've experimented with psilocybin in chocolate bars in states where it is legal, and Mary says it had no effect on them. Paul, do some people not respond in anticipated ways?
Yes, that's correct. The doses, of course, are going to be important. Some people feel that microdosing is effective. There's no data that it is any better than placebo at this point for LSD and psilocybin. Studies need to be done to verify that. But even if one is looking for a more substantial psychedelic experience, of course, we don't know how much was in those chocolates. And I want to point out that even in the studies that we're seeing to be so encouraging for depression and substance use disorders, not everybody responds. And I think people need to realize that this is not a panacea, this is not a magic pill. One other thing that I'd like to point out is that that when we are looking at individuals that are taking this in a study, that there's a whole package, again, of preparation, presence, and integration debriefing afterwards. And somebody that just takes these chocolates at home should not necessarily expect to see the same therapeutic benefit as someone that's in a clinical study or hopefully in a therapeutic regimen once these things are approved by the FDA.
What are the delivery methods in therapeutic clinical trials that are underway?
Typically, we're using capsules of pure psilocybin. There are some companies that are putting an extract of mushrooms that is standardized to the psilocybin content. But in general, we're using pure psilocybin, not mushrooms. And for the MDMA, for the treatment of PTSD, those capsules are also pure drug.
Pharmacist Paul Hudson leads the UW-Madison Transdisciplinary Center for Research in Psychoactive Substances. Attorney David Casimir is a co-founder of Porta Sophia. That's a nonprofit library of information on psychedelic substances. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts on the emerging psychedelics therapy industry. What you wonder? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the therapeutic uses of psychedelic substances, clinical trials underway in Wisconsin, and concerns over the future of psychedelic drug patents. Call in at any point. Ask a question. Share your views. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have David Casimir, a patent attorney, co-founder of the Madison-based nonprofit Porta Sophia. That's a library of information on psychedelic substances. Paul Hudson is director of the UW-Madison Transdisciplinary Center for Research in Psychoactive Substances. Let's bring in Chandra in Ironwood, Michigan. Chandra, hi. What is your question?
Hi there. My name is Chandra. I'm wondering about ketamine therapy. I use ketamine therapy in the privacy of my own home through, I believe there's salt tabs, and for chronic anxiety and pain. And it was very successful, and I was able to get remission from debilitating anxiety. And I'm just wondering, through, you know, various research or PET imaging or, you know, whatever you guys have access to, what is the difference between ketamine therapy and its success rate versus psilocybin or LSD or, you know, ibogaine?
Chandra, thank you so much. Paul, go ahead.
But we really are not looking at ibogaine. Ibogaine's been used as a purported treatment for opioid detoxification or withdrawal support. In terms of comparing it against psilocybin or LSD, ketamine has not been compared head-to-head. A lot of people benefit from ketamine-assisted therapy, but as is the case with psilocybin and MDMA, we feel strongly that individuals who choose to go through ketamine-assisted therapy for depression or other maladies benefit most from incorporating that with a presence of a skilled therapist so that during the dose's effect, they can be counseled and worked with, as opposed to just taking the drug at home. Now, some people benefit from taking it at home, I'll grant you that, but we think that the benefits are greater if they have the therapist there with them.
Do you see in your research, Paul, more comparison type research to other medications like ketamine therapy when you are looking at the future of clinical trials?
Definitely so. The I think that for the psychedelics and MDMA to really move into the market, they're going to have to demonstrate that they are at least as good, if not better, than what we have currently. Now, for PTSD, we really don't have a lot of really good effective drug therapies, and we think that this is going to hold a lot of promise, and we're looking forward to the MDMA being approved by the FDA in the next year or so. With psilocybin, it's going to be a little bit more difficult to compare. We're probably going to be seeing that compared against some of our standard antidepressants, such as the Prozac class of drugs and such.
David, how might patenting a therapy or a substance like psychedelics affect the cost of the treatment in the long run?
So if someone's able to get patent granted and they're willing to enforce it, it can have a significant impact on pricing. When we look at sort of other pharmaceuticals, pricing typically is 50 to 80% higher on a patented drug versus a non-patented drug. But there are certainly examples out there where you can see tenfold or hundredfold increases. And you might expect, you know, I think more substantial increases in the psychedelic space because the existing known drugs are relatively well established and not too challenging to formulate.
Let's take another call. Jane in Lancaster. Jane, hi.
Good morning. My concern is the drug, drug interactions. These are drugs being developed by people who perhaps only eat food with them. What about the people who eat, who take multiple kinds of drugs? And what about the use of these at different ages? Certainly, some people could be more prone to having reactions, which I don't see how they can possibly understand the use and the power of this drug, considering how many people use it and how many different ways.
Jane, thank you. Paul, can you speak to contraindications there?
Now, there have not been many studies that have looked at individuals older than 65 for the treatment with the psilocybin. So we do need to get some additional studies with older individuals. And I think that that's going to be the case with some of the upcoming studies. In terms of drug interactions, we don't really see a lot of likelihood that there are going to be drug interactions in terms of interfering with how the body gets rid of the drug. However, we do find that individuals who are already on an antidepressant, typically we feel need to be tapered off of that antidepressant before they can get the psilocybin, because they the antidepressant seems to block some of the activity of the psilocybin. So we don't really know the effects of all the drug interactions, but from a in general, we do not think that that's going to be a big problem. I think it's going to be more the other psychoactive drugs, the antidepressants, the anti-anxiety agents that they might be on, that we need to tease out yet.
David, when you look at the emerging substances, do patents legitimize psychedelic therapies?
Yeah, they do on in a number of fronts. And I think there's in terms of drug accessibility to the public, there's a complicated interaction between patents and the FDA regulatory process and reimbursement systems by state and federal governments and insurance companies. You know, generally, a company that wants to go through the FDA process is going to try to get a patent because the patent helps them raise funds necessary to cover the very high costs of that process. So typically what you see coming through the FDA are oftentimes patented drugs rather than unpatented drugs. And essentially that limits public access through the FDA to those things that are patented, which may or may not be the best or least expensive options.
Patent attorney David Casimir with us, co-founder of Porta Sophia. That's a nonprofit library of information on psychedelic substances. Paul Hudson with us, director of the UW-Madison Transdisciplinary Center for Research in Psychoactive Substances. Fielding your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. David, in January, Oregon legalized the use of hallucinogenic mushrooms. How will the decriminalization or the legalization of psychedelics, how will that affect therapies going forward?
It's a really interesting question, and it falls into that complicated issue I just raised, because there's the issue of sort of decriminalization, and then there's a separate issue of sort of legalization and sort of regulatory approval and payer approval. You can have something that might be legal, say the use of mushrooms to access psilocybin, But you might then also have a regime where any commercial uses of psilocybin from an FDA standpoint might need to be going through pure psilocybin through particular clinics that are certified. And that may end up influencing essentially general accessibility. People will either have to use things at home, sort of legally in a decriminalized situation, but not in a clinically ideal situation, or go through the clinical route, which will be highly regulated and almost certainly more expensive.
And Paul, you see the clinical route as truly beneficial for potential patients.
Yes, but to come off of David's comment, home therapy may be possible, but I think that that's going to need to be incorporated with preparation and possibly that the therapists are there at the subject's home, as opposed to having to come into a clinic. So how we actually administer this, the setting, the preparation, and where we do that is still something we haven't optimized. We're going to get it across the finish line, I think, with the way that we're doing it now, but it's not necessarily the best way to do it or the most accessible way to do it.
Paul, in our last 30 seconds left, what advances in psychedelic research are you watching for next?
Well, we're getting a much better understanding of how the drug might be working from a biochemical standpoint. There are people that feel that it's a more spiritual experience, but we also are finding some really interesting things, including that we may not need the psychedelic experience at all to have some regeneration or some brain repair. And so David Olson at Davis, UC Davis, is doing some really great work about, and there's a lot of interest in non-psychedelic psychedelics.
We'll be watching that. Paul and David, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Paul Hudson, professor at the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy, director of its Transdisciplinary Center for Research in Psychoactive Substances. David Casimir, patent attorney, co-founder of Porta Sophia, that's a Madison-based nonprofit library of information on psychedelic substances. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.